You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I think you're going to love this one. This is with Scott Rick, who is a marketing professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business, where he has won awards for research and teaching. So his latest book is called Tightwads and Spendthrifts, Navigating the Money Minefield in Real Relationships. And as I note in the pod, this topic of in your relationship, are you a tightwad or a spendthrift, and our assumptions about what it should be and where conflict are, and there's just real surprises and really sort of interesting things in this, and a couple concepts that I'm really starting to bring into my own work and the way we talk about what we do here at Second City. Enjoy the pod.
Unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Scott Rick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I've got to say, I probably read 2 to 3 books a week for this podcast and other things in my work. This particular title, when it was on my desk and people came in, it sparked the biggest reactions. And I am done like 5 years of doing this, 7 years, however we did it. But wow. Everyone was sort of like, immediately it was like, oh, I'm this, my spouse is that. Or making fun of someone else down in the office and that. And was this an easy sell to the publisher? Because I think it would be.
Well, I'm kind of a somewhat neurotic person, so nothing was easy for me. But we were lucky to get some enthusiasm out there. It was. It took me a while to kind of be comfortable, ready to write the book. Because, you know, the money and marriage, we haven't yet answered every single question. Like, that's going to take decades. But I feel like we were at a time where we knew enough to kind of put some hopefully good advice out there.
So the first line of the introduction to the book is, quote, "For many of us, the way we think and feel about money is not ideal," end quote. So I completely agree with that. And that's also not just true for people who are having like money troubles, correct?
Oh, correct. Very much. I mean, certainly if you're in good shape financially, that takes the edge off a lot of problems, but you can still have plenty of money and people within the same house might not feel that the same way. Like if there's a big obvious income difference and that's made very apparent to everyone, they might not both feel the same level of richness. So there are plenty of seemingly wealthy, comfortable couples who have money kind of at the heart of their big issues.
And so you talk about the idea that spending money is often modeled for us. Like, so how was that modeled for you as a kid?
Oh my gosh. Well, not in a typical way, I believe. So I'm a spendthrift, raised by spendthrifts, and grew up in Houston. My grandparents were around. It was lovely. But they were show people. They ran movie theaters and restaurants, and they got bored, and they moved to Vegas. And we went to visit them, like, for entire summers at a time. Mm-hmm. And so I was hanging around casinos, and I looked older than I was, and that was fun then, less now. But they didn't really give me too much trouble, so I got to hang out and watch people play slot machines and hang out in the sports book. So it was like this daily struggle for happiness via spending. And so it was just kind of fascinating to watch this. And it wasn't, luckily we never went like overboard, but you know, it probably wasn't like optimal financial decision making, but it was fascinating. And yeah, I guess I kind of learned that, oh, money is one route to happiness. And but yeah, over the years I kind of discovered, oh, other families do this a little differently. And so it's been a real learning experience.
Yeah. So that made me think about sort of how money was modeled for me. So I grew up in Kenilworth, Illinois, which at that time was the wealthiest suburb in America. So a lot of old school Republican money. And we were the first, or close to the first, Democrats and Irish Catholics in there. Both my parents came from nothing. My dad actually ran away from home when he was 16, and he was in foster homes. And my mom was an only child. There was no money. Dad died young, all that stuff. But my dad did well. And I'm the youngest of six boys. And so, you know, grew up in a really nice summer. But also, like, we didn't go on vacations. There wasn't a maid. Allowance was not nearly as much as it was for other people. But the privilege I think I walked away with in some regards is that I didn't think about money, and was able to, like, I got a job washing dishes at Second City as my first job, and that was okay. And it's not like I asked my parents for money, but I knew there was a safety net. And then, you know, luckily sort of made it into a, you know, actually making a living. But it's when I did, I took your Tightwad Spendthrift scale, and I scored a 14. So I'm right in the middle of unconflicted consumer. And wonderful. I feel like that's good, right?
That's great. Okay. I'm envious.
You did not score that in that area. No. So let's start with getting inside the mind and the brain of a tightwad.
Yeah.
You say in the book, quote, "Much like cheap people, tightwads find spending money painful."
Yes.
How? Why?
Yeah, right. So there seems to be this reaction, kind of the brakes on the car, so to speak, that feelings of distress or anxiety prevent tightwads from buying a lot of things that they know they should buy, and even things that they need. And, you know, they just can't bring themselves to spend the money, and it hurts them and it hurts the people around them. It leads to a lot of regret. And so there's kind of pain before spending and then pain after not having bought the thing you needed. And some tightwads, sometimes this comes from a time in life where money was extremely tight. You know, and some people develop a protective shell, like they work to find spending money anxiety provoking, and that helps to protect them when things are tight. But sometimes later in life, things loosen up. But some true tightwads cannot loosen up with their circumstances. And so I quote in the book, someone from Love in the Time of Cholera.
I love that. Yeah.
Yes. Became a rich industrialist. And someone said, "Oh, you're rich." He said, "No, I'm a poor man with money." That's very different. And so a lot of the tightwads have that mindset where they can't shake off, kind of, financial stress from like their formative years. It sticks with them. And so they always feel like they're on the edge of disaster. So they're very future-minded, very much obsessed with, if I buy now, what am I giving up later? And that's very anxiety-provoking for them. So it's they look good on paper, and that's not nothing.
Nope.
But there is some turmoil there.
So I hang out with enough academics that I know words are really important to you. So you use this word tightwads, but
yeah.
Are we not talking about self-regulation? Are we not talking about self-control? What about frugality? So all these other kind of words that we've got for folks who resemble these behaviors.
Yeah, no, it's cousins with all those other words. And I would say that tightwads have a self-control problem. They have too much self-control. And and frugality is an interesting concept. A tightwad and a frugal person would look very similar on paper. If you looked at their bank accounts, but if you looked in their homes, you might start to tell a difference. Frugal people just love to save. They're not overburdened with a lot of material desire. They believe in kind of reusing items and, oh, don't throw away that old Ziploc bag that's used and dirty. We can clean it and turn it into, keep using it forever. And they just believe in it and they're happy. And That's fine. That's good. But a tightwad, they do have a lot of desires that they just can't execute on. They just can't bring themselves to buy the things that they should be buying.
So as excited as I was by a Gabriel Garcia Marquez quote making itself in the book, good on you, even more excited about Sammy Davis Jr. Oh. Because I had listened to Karina Longworth's podcast on You Must Remember This on the Rat Pack, like a 12, one of those 12-episode arcs, and she covers Sammy and his lifestyle choices.
Yes.
And and you have to tell the story about when he got warned, I think it was by his accountant. So yes, talk to us about Sammy, and I'd love to hear that story.
No, Sammy is my muse. He's my spendthrift hero. Now, he took it a little too far, but his mindset, I like where his head was at. And there was a time where his accountant told him, you got to stop spending so much. You're going to have to keep doing these like crappy shows and like far out venues just to like scrape together money. And he said, okay, I get it. I understand. I hear you. And the accountant was like, good, you got it. And so Sammy, after that meeting, goes down the street, goes to a jewelry store, gets the accountant a solid gold, I think it was like a cigarette lighter, and he gets engraved on it, thank you for the advice about money, love, Sammy. And like the accountant was like, no, you didn't get it. But he just couldn't help himself. But yeah, in general, Sammy was about living an adventurous life, and I don't want to be a elderly millionaire kind of sitting there and burping like, oh, I got $87 million in the bank, burp, burp. And like, what good is it? Like, yeah, I can't do anything with it. So I want to do something with it when I'm young and, you know, still mobile and all these things.
But he felt differently about it from the reporting I saw at the end of his life.
Yes, yes. No, I mean, it's and so that's the challenge for spendthrifts. How do you don't want to leave your future self just completely out in the dark and in the cold. So, you know, what I say is like, even though I love Sammy and his approach, I have a portion of my kind of monthly income kind of automatically going into saving stuff and like kids' college stuff. And, you know, I don't even touch it. And it's not, I don't have any choice to like break into it. So I am taking steps to protect that future self. But then with the leftover money, that's where I become a little more like Sammy, leaning a little more towards on, you know, seizing the moment and not hoping, well, there'll be some other moments later. Hopefully we'll have fun then.
And this is an area that I at least was pretty well read about because we've done work with Richard Thaler. So can you talk a little bit about the idea of mental accounting and how this is like core to a lot of the behavioral science from the earliest aspects of this field?
Yes, yes. So the idea there is that different dollars mean different things depending on how they're labeled or earmarked, and it's hard to kind of have money easily move across accounts. And, you know, tightwads are kind of big on this. They're budgeting. I'm not sure they're budgeting in optimal ways. I think they can do it better, but they do have all these like caps in mind, like, oh, I can't go above this amount. And so it's mental accounting. It's mostly meant to be a self-control device to tamp down overspending, but you can use it to help yourself. Tightwads can use it to help themselves spend more. If they can set aside earmark some fun money in advance, because in the moment, they'll never be able to justify the purchase. But if they've already earmarked some like optional spending money well in advance, it's there, it's waiting for them. They can kind of seize on some opportunities. So spendthrifts, their mental budgeting is it's a real adventure. They're capable of some real gymnastics, and because they're not really constrained. They're not big budgeters. They're not big on like strict limits and
janky math.
Oh my goodness. So janky. And, you know, I could speak from experience. We're really good at like looking at anything as like, oh, that's an investment. This is not just a fun one-time experience. It's an investment in I'll be better at work and I'll be a better parent and I'll have better memories if I do this fun thing. So yes, we are a mental gymnast for sure.
I had lunch today with one of my colleagues who does the sort of financial analysis here, and we were talking about this idea that all money is not created equal, that it depends on the context of all that. And I think it was really interesting when you talk about how retailers have got skilled at this, because I recognize this now that I have the Starbucks app, and buying coffee is different than when I would take money out of my wallet for it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And you know, retailers, businesses, they want us to reach for our wallet as little as possible and think about our wallet. So I want to make it totally seamless and give you kind of digital or otherwise invisible or hard to see ways to pay. You know, the real kind of icon here is like the Amazon Go stores where you just scan your app to walk in, you collect items and walk out. It's like a lot of people say it feels like shoplifting the first time you do it. Like there's no checkout. So you want to erase any association of consumption with payment. And retailers are really skilled at that. Amazon, Disney, pay with Disney dollars. Like it feels like Monopoly money. Club Med, pay with beads for drinks. Like I don't want you thinking about cash leaving your possession. So yes, it's if you want to control yourself, if you're a spendthrift, nobody's out there to help you. You have to make the money you spend apparent to yourself. You have to do things to jack up the visibility of it in your own kind of mental accounting world. So like you got to collect receipts and go home and put it into Excel. And it's incumbent upon you to make it apparent.
All right. So let's jump into how this affects relationships. And you write in chapter 4, which is called Fiscal Fatal Attraction. Nice.
Thank you.
Quote, "We're often too cavalier when using the term opposites," end quote. That sets up the idea that we all might be thinking that, you know, a spendthrift is going to feel this about that, but that's not, it's not always the case, right? There's maybe a lot more going on here than just, you know, opposites attract or opposites are bad.
Yes. Yeah. People are loose with the opposites attract thing. Like when longtime co-stars get together on the same show and they marry each other, they're not opposites. They're sames to me. So normally we do kind of marry ourselves. Democrats mm-hmm. marry Democrats, Republicans marry Republicans. But if there's something we don't like about ourselves and we see that reflected in another person, that can really shine an uncomfortable spotlight on the issue. Like, let's say I'm a nail biter and I'm self-conscious about it. And then mm-hmm. I get together with someone and they're a nail biter. And I'm like, oh, is that what I look like? And I'm just like disgusted by this. Mm-hmm. And I want to get away from them because they're reminding me of my own bad habit. So this could be one reason why tightwads and spendthrifts really kind of get along great, especially at the beginning. Like, it's interesting. It's novel. It's a fun conversation topic. Like, I can't believe you just did that. I would never do that. So we think it's fun at first. And indeed, the opposites here are more likely to get together than two tightwads or two spendthrifts. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's fine at first. But then when you get into a long-term relationship, like there are higher stakes, there are much bigger, important financial decisions you face. And these things that were once kind of quirky and charming could be really irritating if you don't work at it. But you know, a mismatched couple, it's, you're not doomed. I'm mismatched. I'm married to Taiwan. It's wonderful. You just have to kind of take certain steps to make sure things are moving in the right way.
I thought something that you write in here made perfect sense to me when I read it, but I had not thought about it before, which is, quote, "Joint consumption decisions are largely driven by the partner who is most in favor of indulgence."
Yes.
And that makes perfect sense because no, how much will can you expend over time? Like, you're going to give in.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The way I describe this is, you know, tightwads win a lot of battles, but spendthrifts win the war. So if a spendthrift proposes something, you know, indulgent or kind of costly, the tightwad might say no. But eventually the spendthrift will find their moment and the tightwad will say, fine, we'll do it. And then the money's spent and that's it. So decisions to spend are much more permanent than decisions not to spend. Saying no, let's not spend it, that's just the start of a discussion. You can still spend it later. So spendthrifts have that built-in advantage that there's that asymmetry, that their decisions are more final.
Joint accounts.
Mm.
Better or worse for these couples?
I love joint accounts, especially for a mismatched couple. Mm-hmm. They serve a lot of functions. I love it as a psychological money laundering device. I want a joint account at like the front end of the relationship to accept all incoming money, income, tax returns, gifts, whatever it is. It all becomes ours just automatically. That's where it lands first. I want to erase income differences between spouses. I want to put it in the back of our minds as much as possible. And I want to get away from scorekeeping, which couples can easily slide into. Some people have joint accounts, but then the money starts in separate. And then I chip in, 60%, you chip in 40%. I don't love that approach. It can work for people, but that kind of scorekeeping can really degrade relationship quality. So I think the joint account serves an important purpose there. And it just gets you talking. It gets you, you learn more about each other. You can align your goals. That could be saving more. It could be vacationing more, whatever it is. So it's just a big learning opportunity. But I don't advocate only joint accounts. I love the idea of having a separate account for each person on the back end of that, where we can each spend some of our money without close monitoring by the other person, without checking in about every little thing with them. Because you can get into like lots of unnecessary fights, like, oh, why'd you buy the latte at work? Can't you just make your coffee and take it to work? Like, no, I needed that. I needed to step away from my office and my colleagues and have 20 minutes alone. And it wouldn't matter if you save the money anyway. Like, you're going to find some other way to spend it. So these small things can really be the source of unnecessary arguments. So I just say, we each get some money to spend without kind of someone looking over our shoulder. So joint accounts, I think, are great as a receiving device for outside money, but then separate on the back end.
And there was a line in this chapter too that really stood out to me, not just in this context, but in many contexts, was this idea that transparency and trust, that if you have trust, you don't always need transparency. And I was like, oh, that's right. Like the idea, I don't want to know every little thought that goes through your head, because they are little thoughts and some of them are going to be unpleasant and I'm not going to like them and they're meaningless. The same way of like, if I want to buy an album, like a Coltrane album somewhere and get a coffee, that's not, if we're fighting about that, then it's moved into a whole other arena.
Yes, it has. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, what does it mean to be transparent, first of all? Like, what does it mean to be honest? Do you need full, proactive disclosure of every
action? That will not go well.
No. Like, our neighbor looks really attractive today. Like, do you need to say, honey, come check out the neighbor? No, you don't need to do that.
No.
Some things you can keep to yourself. And, so there's lots of bickering over small, unimportant things. We've been convinced that if we could just avoid the lattes or the avocado toast, then we're on our path to riches. But it's just the math doesn't work out. So there's that. And also, we might be into different things. I might have a hobby that you don't understand or a particular interest. And all of those prices are going to seem wild to my partner. Because they're not in that world, and only a real expert will know, like, oh, this is worth the money. There's a reason it's so high priced. And so I think it just can squash individual interests and hobbies and autonomy if you have someone kind of closely watching what you're up to. Now, I do think there should be opportunities for openness, like the details are available upon request.
Yeah.
I just hope the requests are kind of few and far between. Like, if you want a second pair of eyes on what you're up to, please ask. I'm happy to take a look, but I'm not looking as the default. The default is I trust you to manage these things.
I'm a nerd for an experiment I've not heard about before. So can you talk about Margaret Clark's experiment in the lab? This is the pen thing.
Oh, this is the classic. Yes. So yeah. They have people solving like a word search together, and they're going to get some monetary reward based on how many words they find. And the question is, there are some pens on the table, and there are a few black pens, and then there's a red pen also. And the question is, so one person is an actor and the other is like the real participant. And so the actor always selects a pen first. They select the black pen. The question is, do you select another black pen so you can't tell who's doing what? Or do you select a red pen so it's clear that you found six words, I found eight words? So that's like the scorekeeping situation. So they pair you. You are an unsuspecting subject in the experiment. You are paired with someone who is described to you as married and happily in a relationship. There's no real possibility of anything beyond this study. So you're just going to talk with this person for a half hour and then you go your separate ways. So in that case, that's a business relationship. Mm-hmm. I'm going to choose the different color pen because I want to keep track of who's doing what. That's what we do in business. But in other sessions, this person who's quite conventionally attractive is described as like single and open to meeting new people. And maybe you guys can talk after the study. And so now you're kind of, there's some romantic interest. All the participants were like single young men. And so now they choose the black pen because when you're in a relationship, you don't keep score, at least at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so that's what you do when you're in an intimate setting, that we kind of blur our differences. And so I think joint accounts are a way for us to both choose the black pen so we don't keep so much track of who's doing what. It's, you want to push that out of mind as much as you can.
This reminded me a little bit of that study, and I forget who did it, but it was when they had men on a high suspended bridge walk down. Yeah, and there's an attractive woman, and then they felt that that person was attracted to them when it was actually just fear.
Yes, exactly. The shaky bridge.
The shaky bridge,
And you misinterpret that as like, oh, my heart was fluttering. It's probably because she was flirting with me. I should call her. as opposed to the steady bridge where you realize there was nothing there. So yes, there's many fun studies with kind of young heterosexual men looking for love, and they can do some quirky things.
Yeah. So chapter 7, which is called The Secret Language of Gifts, really resonated for me in my world. So there are so many, the term gift is deep in improvisation. We are taught to see all obstacles as gifts. We call a suggestion a gift. Mm. And we do that because we want people to be like, hey, look, like your framing, your job is to take this and make it a gift for you, your partner, seeing partners. And you actually write in this chapter, quote, we often let opportunities to express appreciation and admiration pass us by.
Yes.
That's so true. And it is the easiest thing we can do to brighten not just another person's day, but as Nick Epley always told me, which is like, you're in a bad mood, go do something nice for someone else.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yes. So there's work, for example, asking people, how much do you admire and appreciate your spouse? And then how much do you tell them that you admire and appreciate them? And they're more likely to kind of privately think that than they are to express it. So we're walking around with all these unexpressed kind of nice thoughts about our partner. So why don't we express them? Well, because half the time we're talking about who's going to let in the toilet repair person tomorrow. And we're talking about all these practical matters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people, even within a committed relationship, you can feel uncomfortable and awkward about, you know, expressing your true feelings, and you might not feel like you have the words for it, or maybe your spouse is too tired to hear it and they'll be like, okay, that's nice, I'm gonna go back to Bravo now. And like, it's hard to find the right moment. And yes, so I'm all with the Epley perspective there of it can be so nice to kind of share those nice things with others, but yes, we often let it pass us by.
So this chapter also made me finally understand a gift problem in my own marriage. Mm. So 2 years ago or so, I got my wife one of those electronic frames. So basically that we could load all the photos in it. And it is still sitting upstairs unopened. I offered to like re-gift it to someone. I'm like, I'm not mad about this, but clearly I'm a little mad about it. But then when I read this, I'm like, take a step back. Mm. And what I realized is we have a computer where there are a ton of old family photos that's like, we could potentially lose everything. We haven't touched it. It's giving us anxiety, so we're ignoring it. I'm like, oh, I gave a gift that amplified an anxiety.
Yeah, right.
And there's some other things around that I'm also like, oh, that's insensitive. I had no idea. And I was always looking at it from the end of like, I can't believe you haven't opened the gift I gave you 2 years ago.
Yes. No, I would guess in that case, and this is much easier said than done, like, oh, perhaps that gift is coupled with like an external hard drive where everything's been copied. And so that is taken care of. And now we get this frame, which I preloaded with our favorite, like, I mean, who has the time? But that could be a way around it. But it's so easy to get gift giving wrong and just so many things backfire. And so that was the idea for the chapter. Like, let's see if we can get a little better at this.
So you've got kids?
Oh, yes.
All right. Me too. My kids are total opposites. I have a tightwad and I had a spendthrift. I was just trying to figure out how that happened given that. So what's your experience as a parent with this?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have some differentiation amongst the kids also. The oldest is like the most tightwad and that
same.
Tends to be
yeah.
a pattern. Like oldest is tightwad. And if you have an only, probably a spendthrift.
Yeah.
I was an only, but, so it's, I have quirks that my tightwad wife put up with pre-kids because the stakes were lower. But now when she sees them picking up my habits, it can be a lot more irritating to her if I'm kind of modeling this and turning them all into spendthrifts. Luckily, the oldest is kind of correcting on his own. But and they are just all too willing to come home and report what dad bought for them at Target. and they failed to mention the 1,000 times I said no to everything else. Like, don't I get credit for that? Apparently not.
No.
So it's, you know, kids get a lot of conflicting signals from parents. Like, I've had times where I'm like on my phone and saying, hey guys, get off the screens. Like, and then hold on, let me like something on Instagram. Like, so parents will often say things and then they'll perform something very different. And what the research shows is that, I mean, by and large, the kids are picking up on the behavior that they see.
Yeah.
They might not be able to mimic it right away. Like my kids can't do a unaffordable house remodel at age 8, but eventually when they face that choice, they'll kind of do what was done in front of them. So I've been more mindful of kind of displaying my unbridled spendthriftiness in front of them.
You mentioned the conclusion. So, and I kind of knew the question would be there because, you know, should you marry for money?
No, I mean, first of all, it's not even that you can, it's not practical. Like, it's not like people who have money are just like throwing open their doors and saying, yeah, come in, share our money. Like, they're marrying other people who have money. That's just how our society works. We hang with people who have similar backgrounds and characteristics. There's a line in there about like, oh, doctors used to marry nurses. Now doctors marry doctors.
Right.
And then even if you did marry for money, are they going to be like, oh yeah, this is like, I'm totally fine sharing this. Like all these, this fortune that I've inherited, like, yeah, it's, you know, it's yours. Have fun with it. So there are people who live in mansions that feel very poor because they don't share in the wealth of their partner. So, you know, you need enough money to make it and survive, of course. And you need love as well. That's essential. But you need more than money and love. And that's why I say you got to marry for well-being. You need some psychological similarity. You need to have similar plans and interests and goals. They don't have to be identical. That's a little boring, but similar enough. because we can have all the love and all the money, but if you want to raise 10 kids on a farm and I want to maybe have one kid in the city, it's not going to work, you know, long term at least. And so it's a high bar that I propose for marriage. Like, you need the love, you need the money, and you need the similarity.
And there's another aspect to that too, that you talk about, and I'm not sure if it's a quote from Dan Gilbert, and I'll say this about Dan Gilbert. Dan Gilbert had a podcast length conversation with me about not being able to do my podcast. So we had this 30-minute wonderful conversation.
I believe that.
Like, yeah, exactly. But the quote is, if money doesn't make you happy, then you probably aren't spending it right.
Yeah.
Right. That's it.
that
makes
it.
Perfect sense.
Yes, I agree. And so I'm hoping this book kind of adds to the toolkit that people have for like spending their monies in happiness boosting ways. Yes.
All right. We always close the podcast with a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Yeah. Well, this one's pretty easy. This is our kids. Mm-hmm. We had our first kid, Henry, and I was an only child, and we had Henry as an only, and I thought, okay, this is just how families work. They have one kid, and I was kind of happy with that. And my wife kind of gently pointed out, like, do you want Henry to grow up kind of socially awkward and as weird as you? And that was like the winning argument. So right. That became a yes, but it turned into a yes and, because she had identical twins, and you know, that there was no family history of this, and it just happens. And so now we have three boys, and it's wonderful. It's like my favorite thing, and I'm so glad. I was so in the no space, but the yes and like just turned everything so much better. It's wonderful.
I love it. The book is called Tightwads and Spendthrifts: Navigating the Money Minefield in Real Relationships. Scott Rick, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Screaming at the top of their lungs.
being grown for the rest of your life from adulthood. No one survives.